And for them, did the technology work as they expected? Or?
Well, the technology did, but it threw up something that they weren't expecting. And this was because they couldn't test it in advance. And the reason they couldn't test it in advance was because as soon as they switched it on, it was a very blunt tool, and the Germans would see it from occupied Europe. Even if they did it over Britain, they would see this screen. It was such an invasive thing. They couldn't use it, because as soon as the Germans saw it, they'd know it's important, they'd start planning things to tackle it. So they had to use it for the first time on that night, so they knew it would work. So whilst they practiced the race course pattern, and they practiced that a lot, they never turned on their equipment. So the first time they turned it on was on the morning of D-Day.
Wow.
So there's quite a few risks in leaving it so late. And they discovered one. The flying pattern was such that it was incredibly difficult for the navigators to keep in a very strict position following the race course pattern. And so what they had is they had a navigational aid called G, which was like beams that they could get navigational fixes on that went from radar stations in Britain. They sent out these beams which crossed and gave you navigational fixes. Don't ask me to explain it more.
I can't.
Yeah. A navigator tried once, and I just said, let's accept it worked. And I'm no navigator. But they had this G, which they was a very good navigational aid, I'm assured. And so they were all content that when they got to their position, they'd be able to find G, and then the navigator would just be able to get fixes off this G for the whole time they're up.
Find their place in a circle.
Yeah, exactly. To know where they were. It gave them very strong.
And where their partner was.
Well, meant that they would know where they were, and their partner would know where they were, and so they would always be in the right position in relation to one another.
Yes.
That was the idea. So when they got to their position, they'd been following G, and they knew where their fixes were. They knew they were in the right places. So at the allotted time, they turned on the Mandrel equipment, and G disappeared because Mandrel blocked it out. It blocked out that frequency. It was so blunt that it disappeared completely.
Dear.
So they no longer could see where they were. So the poor navigators, having got over this and sworn a bit, I imagine, were having to go to the astral dome, which is a perspex dome in the aircraft, which is a few steps from where they were in their plotting table, and look at the stars, because, of course, they're overseas. Dead reckoning is, you know, most commonly, most easily done by looking at landmarks. Over the sea, there's no landmarks.
No.
And so you have to do a shot of the stars, and they have equipment that takes rapid shots of the stars, and then they take them back and study them to work out their fixes.
Wow.
So
it's incredible skill and nerve.
Exactly, exactly. And not to fall apart at that point when the aid disappears. Take some concentration, I would say. Yeah. And the thing is, as we said before, it's 95% effective, which is all testament to the skill of these navigators and the skill of these pilots. Really amazing.
Did they all come home safely?
They all came home safely. Whilst they were running critically short of fuel, one had a problem earlier on with radar and had to come back and took off again. And another one had some kind of hydraulic problem and landed at another station, but they were fine and came back later on that night. So, yeah, they're all safe, safely returned.
And what happened after they landed?
Well, after they landed, of course, what they'd wanted to do is go to sleep, but they weren't allowed to. They came out in crew buses and picked them up from their crews. They didn't look like the glamour boys that we always see in
movies.
Not
Tom Cruise on Top Gun.
No, not anyway. Of course, their hair would have been stuck down with sweat, and all the masks would have left imprints on their faces, and they would have looked absolutely ashen and washed out, because they'd be exhausted concentrating for 7 hours. And in rarefied air, so even with oxygen, it takes its toll.
Mm.
So they would have been exhausted. And, of course, what they had to do was the debrief. So what happened is they were taken in the crew buses. They were taken back to the debriefing rooms, which were the interrogation rooms here next to the operations block. And they would have been questioned by the intelligence officer. And all the people that would have been in their briefing in the afternoon, so the meteorologist and the commanding officer and the their wing commander, all would have been there listening to their answers. And they started from very generalistic questions about what they saw, what the weather was like, all that kind of, that's what a meteorologist was there, he wanted to know whether they were accurate, right down to detailed stuff about whether what they were doing worked. And so the briefings could take anything between 15 minutes and half an hour, depending on what they'd seen. And so to pep them up, they were always, as they walked in, there was coffees and teas, which always had rum in them, to try and keep them going a bit further. And they would say everything they wanted, or routine questions. The intelligence officer wrote down all their answers, and it might trigger more questions depending on what they saw. And then the intelligence officer at the end of the evening would write a report, and that would be sent to Bomb Command Headquarters. So it's a very efficient process. And then when they'd finished their debriefing, they went off for their return meal, which was generally egg and chips or egg and bacon. And then they went to bed. Then they went to bed, yeah. Not knowing whether they'll fly again the following day, of course. No, they'd find that out in the morning.
Goodness me.
So they generally rise around 9 and go for breakfast. It was no fixed time. Air crews were a lot freer than everyone else on the station because of what they did. So they could rise more or less as they wanted. And then by 11 o'clock, they'd find out what they were doing that night and who was doing it. And on the 6th of June, so when after all the forces that landed at Normandy were starting to make their struggle across the beaches, here what happened was that they were detailed to fly and then it was cancelled.
Oh.
So it was cancelled at 5 p.m. And the reason it was cancelled was because of objections from the Army and the Navy to Mandrill. Mandrill was such a blunt tool that where they were on the beaches, if they used it again, the Army and Navy wouldn't have any communication.
Oh.
So they didn't let them fly it.
But it gave them some respite, at least.
It did. But actually, they had another plan for it, which was called a creeping mandrel screen, which would protect the bomber force, which is another story. But it would need even more training, because the screen wasn't static as it was on D-Day. It would creep forward, which meant much greater navigational and piloting skills. So from the 7th, they started practicing. They actually flew that on the 14th of June.
Wow.
So, you know, it was heavy work for them.
Yes.
Here. Yeah.
At that point, I'm really sorry, we must stop. You, I know you've got vast amounts of anecdotes. And
there's always the
deed. a calling.
Control tower calling.
A play on words on for words, your draw to the tower. Yeah, and also
exactly.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to bring this period of history alive, really.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.